If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, Rebecca Watson on her debut novel, Little Scratch.
Rebecca Watson is assistant arts editor at the Financial Times, and she has been published in the Times Literary Supplement, Granter and Vogue. And in 2018, she was shortlisted for the White Review Short Story Prize. And Rebecca's debut novel we're going to be talking about today is Little Scratch. Rebecca, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, tell us how you would describe Little Scratch.
I would describe Little Scratch as, I guess, inhabiting the mind of a young woman from when she wakes up to when she falls asleep, no stopping. But it's written strangely. It looks at least strange initially. It's kind of half prose, and it splits into columns and fragments to look at the way in which we experience, you know, immediacy, present tense, and how all of these things are kind of, you know, multitudes rather than one linear, solid line.
But you say there it's sort of half prose. We're going to obviously talk about the style in a little while, but just to pick up on that, have you seen it described otherwise then?
I think people are still working out how to describe it. It's, you know, I mean, some people say at points it's like poetry, at points it's kind of like text. But I think people are perhaps confused by the appearance of it. But if you are to, say, read it out loud, then you would hear it as prose or half prose.
Narrator of the protagonist of this story is unnamed. And as you said, we basically inhabit her point of view for a whole day. Tell us something about her.
Sure. So she's in her 20s, and the day in which we meet her is a Friday in June. And I think the idea is, obviously, we become very, you know, intimate and kind of voyeuristic, you know, a way of seeing her and meeting her. So we've just experienced every single thought she has within one day. And she's an office worker. She works as a kind of administrative assistant at a newspaper or media company. But we don't learn loads about her biography. We know a lot about her kind of most kind of pressing concerns and thoughts. But I think the most we learn literally about her is, you know, this job that she has and kind of a few family and friends around her.
And now it started, this novel started as a short story. In fact, I believe this is the short story that was shortlisted for the White Review Prize. And then obviously it's developed into a novel. So tell us about how it was presented as a story and then how it developed.
Yeah, so the story actually now sits basically exactly in the middle of the book. So it was the lunch break during the day. And I mean, I don't really write short stories, although I kind of accidentally do. I think this, you know, original short story, which was also called Little Scratch, was essentially a passage or a unit of the book. And so when I started writing, I guess I wasn't really aware of what the boundaries were going to be of how far I was going to write it. And I wrote it kind of especially for the White Review Short Story Prize, just because I was trying to distract myself from a different project. And so started writing that, kind of had a moment of inspiration that got me writing a certain moment. And then that short story happened. But as soon as I'd submitted it to the prize, I kept on writing, kept on pushing it, kind of essentially the boundaries on either side to see how far in the chronology I could take it. And so I don't know. It's a kind of strange thing to call it a story when people always ground it as the story. I mean, I think in a way it was, you know, the beginning of the book, and the way that most people begin a book, it's just because it was, you know, published already, it suddenly seems quite confused.
I want to talk about what the challenges of writing this story from, I guess, such a limited perspective. But it's also like, you know, because of, we'll talk about, you know, her pressing concerns in a little while, but because of her frame of mind as well, it's an incredibly claustrophobic perspective as well. So I wonder what it was like for you to actually, you know, to actually get this out on paper and work on it and develop it.
Very intense. I mean, obviously she's very neurotic and also very performative, and so she has an incredibly loud voice. And I often did feel, I was writing, it was quite a kind of quick writing experience, and whenever I was writing, it would, some, particularly some passages would be written very, very quickly. There's a kind of rhythm to it and a speed. And I think that's partly because I would kind of be hearing this voice and be like, right, gotta get this down. Gotta get this down before I lose it. But yeah, it is a very claustrophobic voice. It's intentionally claustrophobic, because I kind of wanted the reader to have to be, I mean, this makes it sound like an unpleasant experience, but you know, they're kind of trapped in this person's head, and you kind of get a sense of what it is to be trapped in someone's head and what it is to kind of live through this day when, you know, things are not right, you know, when someone's suffering from the aftermath of sexual assault. What is that like constantly rather than just in a moment? And yeah, so it was definitely overwhelming, but also I think very familiar. I mean, the real starting point of this was just thinking about like neurotic thought patterns, and that's just fleeting concerns that we might have that we then forget a second later, but in writing them down, suddenly you have to kind of remember them.
There's two things going on here as well. So not only are we sort of privy to the, you know, the innermost neurotic thoughts of the narrator, but also obviously the time period as well. This is over, you know, just one day. And so she is also relating to us time passing as well. And often these things will work in sort of almost two separate columns, two separate streams. So tell me something about that, about the challenges of writing in that dual register of where, you know, two separate things are going on in the narrative.
Yeah. So this kind of started because I was, yeah, essentially was just thinking about immediate present tense. And I think I was frustrated at the way that prose relies on you to wait to the end of the paragraph or the sentence to get like two, three, four things that are happening at the same time. And so really the first thing I was doing was just trying to train myself to say, okay, what really happens in a single moment? What happens in a minute? You know, how much of the exterior world, what we see, what we hear, you know, what hits against our ankles, like these kind of things that exist and, you know, aren't necessarily as important as the thoughts we're having at the same time, and yet we have to coexist with. And so when I was writing the book, it was really looking at those collisions and those coexisting kind of entities and how to get them to the page at the same time, which is why I obviously had to break into different channels. And there's kind of this overwhelming bombardment at times when you have too much going on. And that's, you know, if you're on the commute and you have the kind of announcements going on and the people around you, plus the thoughts that you have, like, how do you navigate that? Like, that is a difficult thing to navigate that we're used to doing. But if you're going through certain things, then suddenly what you're navigating becomes far more literal, you're far more aware of what you're doing.
And I also want to talk about, I guess, the writing. This book it's absolutely engrossing and gripping, and it absolutely flies along as you're reading it, but ostensibly nothing happens. There's not a plot as such. So we're entirely gripped by her own sort of fractured mental state. But literally all that happens is she gets up in the morning, goes to work, does her job, meets a boyfriend later, they go out, they come home. And like, that's literally what happens in the story. And yet, you know, it absolutely grabs you by the throat and won't let go until you put it down. I read the book in like, it's not an incredibly long book, but I read it in two sittings.
It was kind of a concern, but I really fought against it because I wanted the urgency to be found in what seems, yeah, plotlessness. It's this, the kind of nature of existence certainly has this kind of jeopardy, and that's what I really wanted to explore, was the fact that everydayness of just doing the, you know, the daily grind and getting through a conversation with a colleague, these kind of things that aren't meant to be difficult suddenly have this heightened jeopardy when you're also kind of having this very severe psychological reckoning. And so, yeah, it was very important for me that there was this kind of propelling, urgent thread, despite the fact that you shouldn't feel propelled. And that's to do with the kind of subjectivity, right? I mean, obviously we're inside her head, and for her, the question of whether she can get through the day or not is actually a real question. And so I wanted to kind of transfer that urgency into all of these kind of literal physical movements and thoughts, which is why, as you were saying about kind of the way in which the physical exists on the page, like that's so important there in a way of kind of making the reader move on, because you're constantly walking or sitting or doing something with her.
And to what extent was that important as well in your writing of it? What are the sort of challenges of writing a story in this particular format? So when we get to the second half, I want to actually talk about that sort of more prosaically in terms of how it looks on the page. But in terms of you writing it, the process of writing it, how did it look as you were writing it?
Well, I wrote by hand mainly, which helped. And I would kind of write maybe a few thousand words at a time by hand, and then the editing would be in the writing up. And so it looks very similar to how it looks typeset, except obviously it's very immaculately done by my typesetter Kate Ward, and you know, put into kind of far neater ways. But those columns and those overlaps, and you know, when I was writing I would really be jumping across the page. I'd kind of be writing quickly one narrative down the side, knowing I would then be like jumping my hand to the right hand side to then put something else there. And knowing I was kind of constantly playing catch up, because I knew where the things were going to be going on the page. There's a literal system, which we'll talk about, to the page. And so it was kind of this weird seesawing effect as I was writing.
And so let's talk about what that was like then. I mean, obviously they knew what was coming, but when you like hand over these sort of handwritten pages to Faber and say, you know, this is how I would like it to look on the page, how does that, because this is not something I would normally be discussing about, you know, how a novel looks on the page, very rarely, but you know, it's absolutely critical to the reading and the enjoyment of this book is exactly how the words are set out on the page.
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't hand over the like handwritten pages. I would type it up myself, and then you know, I would literally be using the space bar and tab like aggressively as I was going. I think John Self, the critic, shared a picture of my book a while ago, and he made some joke about me needing a new shift key, which I don't, but I can understand why he might think I do. And so I think it was actually really good, because I would go between writing very quickly on the page to having to, because of it being quite like a difficult process to get into Google Docs, you know, you really have to take it very slowly. And so your awareness of the words and what you're kind of inputting becomes something very, very precise. And so I think that really helped to the kind of self-consciousness of the editing process. But when I sent it to, you know, when Faber bought it, when it became, you know, typesetting it, it was really, obviously there were limitations of what you could fit on the page. I was working from a quite wide notepad, and the format of this book is wider than a lot of books are, because we needed to essentially have as much space across the page as possible. And even then there were points where essentially my typesetter would say, look, you can't fit this passage across the page, like it's not physically possible. And so then I would kind of rework it in order to be able to keep it within the confines of the typesetting. And so there were moments like that, and a lot of back and forth as well as she was typesetting, where I'd be like, oh, I'm really sorry, can you please move this bit just a little bit to the left? And she was very, very patiently receptive to all of that. And so it was definitely a very collaborative and lengthy process, let's say.
Well, you mentioned John Self's reaction, but how are you finding people are reacting to the way that the book's set out?
Positively, I'd say, which I don't know. I mean, obviously, because, you know, my agent was very excited about it and there was an auction and stuff. And so there was obviously a real kind of openness to it in a way in which I wasn't expecting at all. And since then, I've found that readers, I mean, now it's published both in the US and the UK over the last few months, I've been able to suddenly be tapped into kind of the general reader reaction. A lot of people have, you know, messaged me on Twitter and told me about their reaction to it. And so many of them have essentially said completely what I wanted them to react, which is that, you know, maybe initially they were sort of taken aback by how it looked, but quite quickly they found a kind of intuition to it, and maybe they recognized certain patterns from their own thoughts, but they were able to kind of navigate the page in what felt like a very kind of instinctive way, which is, yeah, exactly how I hope them to do.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Rebecca Watson, and we're talking about her debut novel, Little Scratch. And Rebecca, in the second part, I want us to talk a little bit more about the subject matter of the story. Before we get there, the book is surprisingly funny in a lot of places for a book that's about fundamentally about rape and workplace harassment. And there's one particular passage I thought was funny where you talk about autofiction. And you work in journalism, and you know, it seems to be my experience over the years of interviewing authors is that young women journalists and writers are much more likely to be sort of pressured into writing about themselves, their personal lives, their own experiences. Now, this is a work of fiction, but it's a first-person unnamed narrator. And I presume you are playing with those sort of ideas in this book, because there are a lot of people that are going to read this and wonder if it's autobiographical.
Absolutely, there will be. Yeah, and I'm glad to pick up on that autofiction moment, because yeah, it's this point in the book where I think she opens a WhatsApp chat and sees that these people are discussing how this writer must be actually writing about themselves in the novel. And the narrator both agrees and disagrees at the same time against herself. And I think, yeah, it was kind of a funny moment for me. And I really remember writing that passage and being like, okay, some readers might feel told off at this point. Because, yeah, this is very much a work of fiction, but I was, you know, playing with, I don't know, there was almost something playful about it, about stealing some environments I know. Like, you know, I know what it's like to work in a newsroom. I'm obviously a young woman, but these kind of environmental tags are very broad stroke things that they don't tell you anything about a person, but can be very easily, you know, can very easily spot the comparisons. But, you know, her story is not mine. And so I definitely had fun with it. I actually wrote a brief character into the book who is me as a way of kind of being able to push away and say, well, actually, you know, I'm elsewhere, which is this character, her colleague, actually, who offers her tea.
Oh, the woman that keeps coming over and being nice to her.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's a kind of almost, I don't know, I describe her quite positively because I figured that the narrator of my book is going to see the author as someone, you know, quite positive. You know, I've brought her into creation, so the least she can do is kind of admire the back of my head. And so, yeah, there is a kind of essentially a walk-on character in the same way, I guess, that many filmmakers like to stick themselves in for a three-second cameo, which was just a way of pointing elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, I've definitely already had many loaded questions about, you know, trying to connect my own experiences to the book. I think people are very, I don't know, very obsessed with finding truth. You know, it's almost this thing of feeling uncomfortable about reading something that feels real, but it not being real. It's like we can't reconcile that. And so we have to be able to kind of, you know, sew it up neatly.
And have you found that as well in your own career that as a journalist, that you're sort of expected to be more open in your writing?
I think I kind of just write what I want to write, which is maybe just out of, you know, the certain situations that I've been in where I've been able to choose, or because I've only said yes to what I want to do. I think, you know, that is definitely a thing that happens. But yeah, I wouldn't say it from my own experience.
Can we talk about writing about sexual assault, rape? The assault that the narrator has experienced is a very intense, violent experience that she's had.
It's a very... I think I really shied away from writing it kind of too gratuitously. You kind of get fragments, shards of it, insinuations, but I didn't write a rape scene, and I didn't want to. I think that my ambition when I was writing this book was to look at genuinely the ways in which memory works through trauma. And, you know, one of the key things is that trauma fractures memory. Often survivors of rape can struggle to remember accurately what's happened to them, or at least in kind of a very clear linear way, or at least not initially. And so I really wanted to write against linearity, to depict it in this kind of fragmented, ambiguous and nuanced way, which is why, yeah, as I said, I didn't write a kind of linear rape scene or a linear understanding of it. And I think, to be honest, like, the experience of writing that kind of taps into everything. You know, the fact that within this book, the fact that we don't have a kind of clear biography of her life, all of these different things are kind of different explorations of, like, essentially diverting from linearity. And I wanted her to have a kind of, you know, hard-won place where she isn't redeemed, she isn't, like, resolved. There isn't really a kind of any resolution or solution or anything. You know, you end the day as you began the day, and, you know, some people may end up thinking that there is hope, and other people may end up thinking that the next day is going to be exactly the same. I think it was important that that was how I ended it.
And indeed, she's ambiguous about what's happened in terms of, I mean, I guess through learnt experience, in terms of how rape and sexual assault is dealt with, both through the legal systems and obviously in sort of work power structures, in that this violent attack has happened. She's had this experience, but she's not told anyone. She's obviously not told the police. In fact, she's trying to get on with life. It's her way of, whether this is her way of dealing with it or just that she knows that there's almost no point attempting recourse for this, for what's happened to her.
I really don't want to, like, make an assertion beyond what she says. I kind of feel like I'm putting words in her mouth, even though I'm the writer. But I think the idea was all of those things and more sat in the book, but I don't think she's even necessarily clear on why she's doing what she's doing. Or even, I'm not sure that she's actually reached a decision yet. Like, this is the kind of space of time when she's still not even fully confronting what's happened to her, at least for most of the book. A lot of this is happening kind of as background or as moments of, like, attention before it's thrust back.
Because also, I mean, I don't know if I just missed this, but we're not actually sure when this actually happened.
No, there's a bit, there's, like, basically one mention near the beginning where it implies that it's about 6 weeks ago. And that's when she's on the train and she talks about how long it's been since she last wrote. And there's a connection to that where there's a kind of psychological block of writing, which which is connected to like her inability to confront what's happened to her. And so it's about that length of time ago. I think some people will initially misperceive it as having happened the night before, because she wakes up with a kind of grogginess and confusion, which is from something separate. And so, you know, these things exist in this kind of haze and kind of unclarity initially, or maybe for the whole book, because she's not, it's that thing of like, if you're inside someone's head, knowledge is immediate rather than explained. And so there are certain things that she will not think in a clear factual way, i.e. this thing happened then, or today is, you know, X number of weeks from this. And so, yeah, I think I was really trying to push away from those kind of easy planted things that a writer might put in a book in order to kind of give a clear timeline.
Can we talk about if there are other writers that were an influence on your, I'm thinking particularly of the style of the book here.
Well, I really struggle with the answer to that question, just because I kind of felt for this, I mean, this form particularly was something that, you know, I really devised on the page, and it was a system that was new to me, and it, you know, it didn't come from someone else or kind of reading a certain type of writing. I think there are certain people I can kind of say, okay, maybe they did something, but they might not be that obvious. Like the Spanish novelist Javier Marías, who very much writes in straight prose. But I would say he was a real influence because he writes these sentences that, you know, just like go on and on and on and take you from one place to another and then right back to where you started. And that kind of pushing and pushing and pushing on like the sentence and how far a thought can take you was something that I remember thinking about from the first few hundred words I wrote, where I actually remember thinking in my head, no, keep going. When I was about to finish a sentence, I was like, no, keep going. You can do this. Like if Javier Marías can, you know, extend you across three pages, you can keep carrying on for a little bit. And so people like that, Sarah Kane, the playwright, for her, the kind of violence of language that she writes and the kind of ways in which, you know, neurosis and trauma can really just like burst you out of kind of commonplace language. And I think a lot of the kind of uses of like expletives and aggressive language, I'm sure is inspired by her. But in terms of form, that's when I struggle to say who.
To finish off then, can I get you to read us a bit?
Yes. I just want to read a short bit, which is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She's just suddenly remembered the morning, basically. It's that kind of point in the day where you think, oh yeah, like, wow, I woke up this morning, this is what I did. And you kind of ground yourself back in the day. Remembering the tepid water by my bed, this morning, awake to a dry mouth, then hungover, now seemingly fine. Fine as in not hungover anyway. I'm not fine in the general sense. I've made that clear, reserved enough space in my head for acknowledging that I'm not fine. But yes, it is the point in the day where this morning no longer feels like this morning. And yet it was, obviously. I didn't have time to dawdle, to float. I just drank water and showered and hurried and felt okay because I did not have time to feel any other way. A new tactic, perhaps. Setting my alarm late, overfilling my time. I know that this will not work, but I consider it. If only to fill the space where I could be thinking something else. Yes, from now on, I'll arrive everywhere late and start everything late and oversubscribe until my eyes burst and my head hurts. It already does, but even more, I guess. Body stretched until I do not know who I am or what I want or where I am or how I got here or what happened to me that time, hands on me, mouth full, saying no, 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 yes, that time then, which I'm not thinking about. Instead, I think about art galleries. A decent diversion, no. I decide, without much decisiveness, I will no longer go to art galleries with other people. It is too much. Having to give an allotted time to each painting, staring without seeing. Has this painting been given enough attention? Will my companion suppose I've appreciated it now? It's not that I don't like art, naturally. It's just I can't like it all. I don't have the reputation that allows me to be selective, to walk into a room and examine this one and this one, cursory glance at the rest, shake head and move on. Sometimes I think, art is incredible. popular opinion. But sometimes I think, what do I actually get out of it? How much more am I getting than when I see an attractive person on the tube and take the time to notice each part of their outfit, clocking through, studying the fringing on their trousers and the way they've drawn liner across their lids before moving back to staring into nothing? What is the difference, really, truly, honestly? Yes, other times this seems to me a ridiculous argument to make, one I do not agree with whatsoever and would not condone, would frown on if someone were to make it. But I cannot stand still. I find myself flitting, doubting I have the capacity to appreciate or understand, wondering if there is even anything there to understand. And when I flit to this, I fear I will not return, and all the while I must firmly assert that I'm not thinking it. Firmly assert my appreciation and understanding of art, never allowed to have doubts. And these doubts, which I have regardless, mean even when I'm not having doubts, I remember that I've had them and fear that I might still be faking it somehow.
So I've been talking to Rebecca Watson. We've been talking about her debut novel, Little Scratch, which is out now in the UK from Faber. Rebecca, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.